Hey, good morning, Sasha.
Hi.
And what time is it in your part of the world this morning, this
Oh,
evening?
perfectly decent hour. It's at 10 p.m., just after 10 o'clock p.m.
Oh, well, that's not too bad. Not too bad. Not too terribly bad. So, Merry Christmas, almost Happy New Year to you.
And the same to you, Sherry. Lovely to see you again.
So, for those of you who don't know who this is, it's a little bit grainy. I'm sure it's because it's bouncing from all over the world. This is my friend Sasha Stone, who's coming in from Bali, and I can't wait to talk to you. I've got some questions I just really need to ask you. You and I are on so many of these conference calls together. Some of them you lead, some of them we just happen to be participants. But there's a couple questions I can't wait to ask you. So we're just we've got a whole bunch of people. You know, this little counter thing at the top is never right. It's always thousands of people. So I mean, when you click it off and you want to save it to Instagram Live, it tells you how many people are actually listening. So it's so just so you know. So good morning, good evening. This is my good friend and comrade in arms, Sasha Stone, coming to us from at 10 p.m. from Bali. So Sasha, you know, tell me just a tell for people who may not know, just a little bit about your background, how you went from being a rock star to an activist. I
Well,
just find that so
honestly,
story so interesting.
it's very kind, but it was more of a disaster than a rock star because I wasn't very well behaved in rock and roll, and I did it for many years and I thoroughly enjoyed it, and we were, it was a damn fine outfit, and we had a lot of fun, but it's not something which I ultimately wanted to purpose my life toward beyond a certain point, because it was clear that by signing with the devil, one was really indentured for life, and that was it. And you know, being asked at the age of 28, 29, whatever I was when I retired, 20, about 29, to hand over your life and all of your publishing and all of your copyrights and everything, and you wouldn't effectively own any part of your creativity, and you'd spend the rest of your career doing the bidding of 23-year-old coke snorting A&R men in the corporation, record labels, and jumping through hoops. And I looked at older bands who'd been around 20 years longer than my band and thought, do I really want to be doing that at the, in my mid 40s, mid 50s and 60s, repeating the same thing? And I just thought, no, it's not like it was back in the 60s or the early 70s, which was the heyday of rock and roll. For me, it's all about Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin and Creedence Clearwater. And that was true rock and roll. But clearly by the 90s, when I was in that life, it was industrial harvest. And so I just decided I'll fall on my sword. I did. And I immediately went out to the Middle East and spent 2 or 3 years just really sitting in the Moroccan sun between Morocco and Egypt and repurposing my life toward what I had a fair bit of influence at that time anywhere. And I had a lot of access, celebrity access, and to leadership. And I could make phone calls and open doors. And I just, all I did was work that to launch Humanitat Foundation. And played that card, moving around the world, meeting as many political and religious and cultural leaders as I could over 5 years to build up a essentially a groundswell of political and diplomatic support for the work I wanted to do, which was to really get involved in changing the status quo. Because I'd grown up in a war in Africa for the first 17 years of my life, I wanted to find resolution and remedy to all of that, you know. But I learned after 4 or 5 years of this diplomatic constant traveling that I was doing, meeting with leadership and building up my foundation, I realized that the whole goddamn roadmap ahead was rigged anyway. Peace? What is peace? And I had good leaders. I mean, I'm talking heads of state, crowned royal heads sitting me down and saying, listen, son, you're wasting your time. There is a bigger agenda which you're never going to be able to thwart with your peace initiatives and your, education initiatives and your intercultural, interfaith, blah, blah. Don't waste your life. Go do something, And I was getting that feedback from good people, leadership, who were saying you're wasting your time because we do not factor peace in or fellowship in the business model.
So take like one step back from that. So the foundation you were founding, the name of it, and how did you get to open all those doors? You just called and did that?
No, I had that access. I mean, I had, but at the end of my rock and roll era, we were all hanging out in Monte Carlo and Hollywood, and it was that was my circuit. You know, it was all triple A and full access. So it was easy enough to make phone calls and get in front of people and just leverage and leverage and leverage. And I've always been pretty good at that, and that's what I did. You know, simple as that.
And they were all telling you not to bother. So what year was that, Sasha? About approximately when was that?
Well, we're talking 21 years ago, which is when I set up. 1999 was when I retired formally. I carried on recording for a couple of years, but I started my political, diplomatic activism work and learning, you know, learning the ropes at that time. It took me about 5 years to understand the lay of the land. And then I actually threw myself into more hardline activism, because I realized after 5 years of playing into the status quo, you know, with the Nelson Mandelas and the Dalai Lamas and playing that kind of middling sort of quite libertarian type peace activism, which is not to say much at all. You know, you're going around trying to set up peace festivals. You're trying to generate peace initiatives and cultural initiatives, interfaith. That's the kind of thing I was working at, and wondering why, whenever I came close to pulling off something really big, the carpet would be pulled. And then I realized, hang on, people like me are factored in to the business model, and we're allowed to pretend to be changing things within the UN or whatever to a certain extent. But if you really begin to tamper with the business model, they'll come at you with the jackals. And they did with me. I mean, they actually did come at me with the guns and dogs and what have you. So I had horrible run-ins on, I think, five occasions. We were counting the other day, which were pretty, you know, life or death. And that stuff I'll look back on in my twilight years and probably get a bit of a rush over. But it, you know, a lot of it's been very ugly. So by the time I got there, but 2007, 2006, 2008, I started really waking up. And then I started saying, this is it. I've got to now change my modus operandi. I cannot be this Pacific egalitarian kind of peacenik bullshit, you know.
But Sasha, so let's just put this, it gives me a great question to ask you. So if you were doing that, let's say 2000 to 2005, just to keep the numbers even. So that was 20 years ago. And yeah. And so now when we look at what's happening with the WE Forum, you know, the World Economic Forum, the WEForum.org folks, the Davos people, what you said about that, you know, you were told by all of these people at the highest level of echelons where you were that, listen, you don't see the bigger picture here. That was 20 years ago. Do you feel like what's happening right now is just sort of a play out of more of the same of what was happening back then? And how does that make you feel about current events?
It's different because I think that in those days there weren't many people like me doing what I was doing. It was a rarity. It was a rare bird in that echelon. But I mean, all of them, from the Kissingers to the Soroses to the Pelosis, I've had these kinds of characters. I've had my dinner invites in those echelons. I've had access to all of those people. I had access to Henry Kissinger over 20 years ago. It only took me 4 or 5 years to realize who the hell he was. I think my mum said, like, what the FK are you doing, you know, in any kind of communication with these people? And I was like, what are you talking about? These are statesmen. These are, you know, and she was like, no. But the point is, I was very naive for the first few years of my peacenik work. And I was in contact with a lot of people who I now realize were absolutely part of the Illuminati, part of that echelon. And of course, I've subsequently completely demonized that aspect of the human family, and I castigate them every chance I get, and I tear down masks and do everything I can to not just unmask, but also to destroy certain agendas. And I feel impervious to it. I feel as though I'm inured in a certain way because I've had so many pops taken at me, serious pops as well, not you know, just haphazard things, proper, you know, people really sent to harm me, and, you know, guns and poison and horrible stuff. So I've had those incidents happen to the extent to which I now believe I am somewhat impervious, without any arrogance there at all. I genuinely think that if you were given to walking in an absolutely straight line in this world, whoever you are, and you're standing in that flame of what I call pure truth, and you're enacting and embodying what I call right action, I genuinely believe that to be the Christ flame. I think that's the catalyst for this Christ flame that every single being on earth has access to. But it means absolute conviction in the truth and the right action of what it is that you're purposing your life toward. And that's passion. I mean, that's a fire. And if we're in that space, and I've been in that space a long time, and I've seen how that creates a certain immunity, put it that way, to real harm. And that's why I feel I can walk into certain places that I wouldn't recommend anyone else do it. You know, not because I'm brave, because I'm not.
Was there, during that period of time, was there a particular event or a series of events that was sort of like the holy crap, you know, the wake up moment, the aha, that there is a bigger thing here and I need to do something different. These people are not what I thought. Was there a particular event that stands out for you?
Yes. Yeah, the first time I had a gun at my head and I was going to meet someone in the Middle East who I ought not to have been going to meet. And technically, I'd been warned and told of the dangers. And I was like, yeah, well, you know, I'd already booked the ticket kind of thing. And I ended up having a gun at the temple and in a very remote spot. And it was just me and the chap with the gun at my head, and they'd been waiting. He'd been waiting for me, but I could see that he was a kid. I could see he was 22, maybe 23. He'd been taking orders. I was older than him, and I could see also in his eyes that because he'd been waiting for me at a particular venue, at a particular late night on the outskirts of a town in the Middle East, and I saw the look in his eyes, and I saw that he was more afraid than I was. And that was the curious thing, because he was taking orders. And I started smiling. First I smiled, and then I started like laughing at the absurdity of this situation, that here I am, you know, I'll probably not see my mum again, you know, and no one will ever find my bones here. And I just laughed at the absurdity of it, because it was absurd. And then something infectious happened, and he kind of giggled. Like when he saw me laughing, he thought that I knew something that he didn't know. And it just disarmed him. And the next thing, we were both looking at each other like, really? What are we doing here? And he unclocked his weapon, and that was that. And I kind of walked away from that. And I had another incident worse than that, with guys with machine guns in a desert. Let's just say, leave it at that, when I was going to somewhere where I ought not to have been going to meet. I was at that point wanting to meet with warlords, because it was just before 9/11, and I had this terrible foreboding in 2000 and early 2001, and even to an extent late 1999, I had a terrible foreboding about the clash of civilizations, but between Islam and Christianity. I could see that was coming, and I made it my task to go and meet with warlords, including bin Laden, just so you know. I mean, I wasn't the Pakistani high commissioner, whoever it was, wouldn't let me get through Pakistan to get to the Hindu Kush. So I had my that particular trip blocked. I got to meet Sheikh bin Laden, the brother of Osama, and which was neither here nor there. They're a big family. But I wanted to go to the Hindu Kush, and I wanted to be taken, you know, to meet with him. And I wanted to sit with him, because I believed in that myth at the time. Now I know very differently about bin Laden and the situation. You know.
You believed in what myth?
Well, I believed in the myth. I believed that that he was probably, you know, sitting there in the Hindu Kush, hiding away from the special forces. And that good, because I was also at that time, I need to say this, I was also since 1999 a student of Islam, not because I'm a Muslim, because I'm not, but I had seen in 1999, which is what had compelled me to really move hard and fast into peace activism. I had sensed that this Huntingdonian clash of civilizations was absolutely imminent. I felt it in the marrow of my bones. And so I started swatting up in London, learning all of the schools of Islam, feverishly reading up. I went to meet Cat Stevens, Yusuf Islam, who's a famous Muslim cleric now. I met him first. I went to the Middle East, to Egypt, and I met with the Grand Mufti, the Pope of Islam. I was taken in at dawn one morning at gunpoint to meet him in the turret of the great Al-Azhar Mosque, which you never, someone like me never gets in there. But I had lobbied very powerful military officials and imams, and I'd convinced them of my knowledge of the hadith and the surah of the Quran at that time, sufficient for them to agree to bring me before the Grand Mufti. So I had that, and once I got the blessing of the Grand Mufti, which was incredibly rare, I don't think anyone else has ever had that, certainly hadn't happened by the time I got there. But when I was brought before him, albeit with a bunch of guys with Kalashnikovs, it was fascinating, because, you know, there he was, the most powerful man in the world, in a sense, I mean, in that whole kind of Islamic world. The man who sets the sun, moon, and stars at Ramadan, the man who has this huge sway that you'll never even know his name. I knew it. It was Sheikh Al-Tantawi Al-Azhar. You know, he was a little man, and I looked at him, and he looked at me, and he was like, you know, spoke through a translator, said, "What do you want? Why the devil are you here? And what compels you to camp out in the desert month after month after month, insisting on meeting me?" And I said, I need to hear from you, something from your mouth. And he said, "Well, what is it?" And I said, "I need to hear from you that the religion of the human heart takes precedence over the religion of Muhammad." Now, I would never say that today. And just so you
know, wait, what was the answer?
He loved me. He said, "You are a true Muslim." He said, "You understand Islam." And he said, "Yes, effectively." He said, "Effectively, yes. The religion of the human heart is the quintessence, is the message of Prophet Muhammad. May he rest, may peace be upon him." So you see, that was me going to meet the man. I didn't want to read shit about men, about famous men, about remarks. I wanted to go and meet them, and I want to hear what they had to say. I wanted no intercessionaries. That's why I wage war against all intercessionaries now in my work. All of
them. So wait, stop.
The message is broken.
So when he said that, and what was the end of that meeting, and what happened after that? I mean, that's really a powerful, that's really
it was remarkable.
a pivotal moment in, yes. in not yes. only in your yes. life, but in maybe in humanity. What came out of there, and how did that change the direction or add to the direction you were going in? What happened from that meeting?
I'm so happy, Sasha. I'm so happy you're asking me the question, Sherry, because I've never been asked the question before. And it is one of the most important things that ever happened in my life. And I never thought that anyone would ever care enough to ask the question. So what came out of that for me
was an implicit
understanding then and there that this war of civilizations that was fomented was an agenda that was being played by the Sabbateans and had nothing to do with the atom seed of Islam wanting to wage war against the atom seed of Christianity.
Wow.
So I then realized, oh yeah. And so my work then became, okay, I am the man who's come and I've seen and I've heard and I've spoken the word, and I'll go away knowing that. And I've subsequently caused so much shit for the Sabbatean agenda by meeting with so many religious leaders. And we counted the other day, or tried to. We lost count after 230 something kings and queens and heads of state that I've met.
Oh my gosh.
So, yeah, and so the point is, I've had these private conversations, and they continue to this day, and behind closed doors. And I'm not saying I'm not in favor in particular with the elites, but there are a hell of a lot of good leadership. There are hundreds and hundreds of kings and queens in the world. There's a couple of hundred in Africa alone. There are thousands of paramount chiefs. So my work is, you know, I'm hardly scratching the surface, but I have been seeking to meet with seminal cultural leaders and hereditary leaders and elders and, you know, cultural icons. And of course, obviously the imperial crowns as well. I've met with many of them. I've had dinner with members of most of the leading royal families in the world and had some kind of conversation. And certainly I've got a lot of mutual friends in those circles. And if we want to talk about, you know, things like shape-shifting reptilians, it's a conversation I've had on multiple occasions with members of royal dynasties? And the short answer is yes, it exists. What can I say? I'm not going to bullshit. I mean, this
Sasha,
is stuff
so that- Sasha, go back just a second, because this is really important and it's really pivotal to the work that you're doing now, the work that you're doing now with the New Earth Project. I mean, you are obviously on a spiritual and personal quest to talk to the most influential people about very key questions. So when you had those pivotal conversations, I mean, 230 kings and queens, but with that particular conversation with the Imam, that's very interesting to me. I mean, when you walked away from that conversation and went to wherever you went to next, what did that leave you with? I mean, that obviously was a life-changing, pivotal moment. It had to have been. I mean, you spent
it
a long
left me,
time.
It left me with love. It left me with love, because
you realized that love was driving
was the,
all of
it. It was the inertia behind Islam in the same way. And this, I've studied Islam so keenly in the same way that I've more or less studied Christianity, although I find Christianity so much more complex because of the different schools which were evoked through the Christian message. And so many of it has been weaponized as well, of course.
Yeah.
But in Islam, I found, I mean, and I have to say, because I've lived for many years amongst my Muslim brothers and sisters, and there is a spirit, a camaraderie, and a fellowship amongst humankind in the Islamic world that I've not seen anywhere else on earth. And that's just the way it is. It's just the way it is. And this idea that they've been so demonized and castigated and vilified by the Western mind and the gestalt of the West, but that's all weaponized media and academia and, of course, right-wing Christian fundamentalism. But let me give you a little trick here. Not many people know that the two horns to the devil controlling this global narrative of the clash of civilizations is basically one horn, and it's the Gulf Texas Mafia. So it's the House of Saud, the Wahhabi fundamentalist Islamic agenda, and the fundamentalist Christian Zionist agenda operating out of Texas oil fields. So the oil and gas is the thing that binds those families, which is why the Bush family and the House of Al Saud were so indelibly interconnected. So in Bahrain, Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, and all of those countries are very locked in. They're the Gulf Mafia, and the Texas Gulf Mafia owns effectively the Federal Reserve. So the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury and the consolidation of the reserve banks all around the world, folding into the Bank of International Settlements and the IMF, which is the pulse of the parent corporation, meaning to say the Crown, the Bank of England, and then the Vatican and the Black Papacy. So that's essentially Satan Central is the Vatican, the Black Papacy, no question about that. Okay, the Roman Catholic Church has been the greatest cover story in history for 2,000 years, and no disrespect to good Catholics there. There's a lot of beautiful mystical tradition there, and I'm not disavowing that for one moment, but I'm the one to tell you that it is venal to an extent that you could not believe. I'm speaking right now to one cardinal in the Vatican who's there in the Vatican, in the College of Cardinals, and feeding me information, and I'll tell you, it is staggering. I'm not prepared to say too much right now, but I can tell you this much, that he is informing me categorically that the big religious war is what is being fomented right now. They've already started battening down the hatches. They've already started to take many of the treasures and the things back into the catacombs and the basement in San Sofia in these different cathedrals around the world, Christian cathedrals. They're getting ready for a religious war that they are absolutely fomenting and intend to catalyze in 2021.
And what will that? What does that mean? I mean, a religious war versus a non-religious war. I mean, what's the difference? What's going to happen with that?
I don't know. All I know is that the Vatican and the Crown of England are, in a sense, leaning against one another and propping each other up at this stage, and that the Trump and white hat element in the Pentagon and in the NSA in North America. So this small, very, very courageous echelon operating between the White House, the Pentagon, and the NSA right now is essentially the glittering sword of of the Christed flame, as far as I'm concerned. That is what we're seeing, and that power that represents. Because don't forget that little tripartite right now, what I call Trump and the white hats, is consolidated by something immensely powerful, which is the pulse of Middle America. And people forget this. That is the pulse of Middle America. That is that represents the atom seed of the entire human family. That's what America is. America always was that. It was the great cauldron of the human experiment in the seeding of humanity. And that pulse has begun to awaken. And that pulse is the thing that is behind Trump and the Pentagon and the NSA good hats. And that will absolutely slay this Sabbatean Zionist Khazarian mafiosi that goes back 4,500 years pre-Phoenician. It's over. As far as I'm concerned, it's a done deal. You know,
which part is the done deal?
The takedown of the Sabbatean Zionist agenda. It's going to take another 3 or 4 years to completely reduce that to ashes. But this idea that we're moving into an Orwellian no, we're not moving into an Orwellian anything. We're going to have a serious bitter pill to swallow in the coming few weeks, and it's all going to emerge in the next few days. I mean, arguably it'll take until from the 6th of January to the 20th of January, from the House vote to the inauguration, and that's really when the treason proper will be enacted, and it needs to be enacted for it to be treason.
You know,
and then the martial privilege can kick in, and the insurrection laws and martial laws can kick in, and there can be a relatively clean, swift operation, in my view.
You know, it's so interesting, Sasha, because I've been saying that, you know, since probably middle of July, maybe, when I've said that, you know, with the election with Trump, it's sort of like we're damned if we do, damned if we don't. You know, if he wins, it's going to be one set of chaos. If he loses, it's going to be a different set of chaos. But that the period of time between the election and the actual inauguration was going to be pivotal for the U.S. for sure, but probably for all of humanity. And you've just sort of confirmed that with all the things that you've known. So with all of the people that you've talked to and all the experiences that you've had, how do you put what's happening on this global shutdown, this whole thing with the Davos crowd, with this whole Klaus Schwab, you know, World Economic Forum nonsense? I mean, give me your perspective on all of that, because it sort of is a push out or a push up from all the experiences that you've had.
Sure. Well, Klaus Schwab, who is one of obviously the most venal characters lurching on the surface of the earth. And, you know, the World Economic Forum, this is a quote from Klaus Schwab a week or two ago. The World Economic Forum are working with the Biden administration to ensure that most people will survive the oncoming food shortages. Well, how does he know? You know, but this is so classic of Davos. The Davos man is the invertebrate that evolves off the rogue human. So humanity takes a fork in the road in the 21st century. At the dawn of the 21st century, humanity takes a fork in the road. And on the left fork, you will find figures like Schwab leading an invertebrate class of humanoid. And to the right will be yourself, Sherry, and myself, and other folks with red blood coursing through our veins, and some kind of spiritual morality, you know, pulsing through our hearts. But, you know, it's almost of no consequence, the Schwabs and the Davoses. They've already done unto themselves. Their trade compacts, their tariff rigging, all of the godless multilateral treaties that they have fostered and engendered, financed through the United Nations and OPEC and the World Trade Organization, the World Health Organization, all this godless bullshit. I don't forget, I'm a former director general at the United Nations in the IGO sector. I know all about that crap. That's why I hacked into that godless institution 10 years ago in order to learn and see for myself. Again, I didn't believe everything I was hearing. I wanted to see for myself what was going on in the basement. And I did. And I was satisfied after 2 years. I didn't take a dime from the UN. I never took a salary, but I had a director generalship there. And I have very clear understanding now of how to structure multilateral treaties. I know how to bribe and coerce and blackmail governments. I know how to do it. It's not complicated. And this is the Kissinger and Soros and Brzezinski's game over the last half a century. So really, three or four Zionist, Sabbatean, Khazarian mobsters were kind of heading it up subsequent to 1962, whenever the UN was fully formed. You know, but and this is all something which was, again, engineered off the back of the League of Nations. Purposefully, because the League of Nations ultimately didn't fulfill its mission. They realized they had to create a more complex system, which they did. And the League of Nations, of course, issued off the Cecil John Rhodes Roundtables. And the Cecil John Rhodes Roundtables is the classic Jesuitical tradition of completely owning the outcome before you've even sat at the table. And that's all it is. But that Sabbatean logic, that goes back to Ignatius Loyola, the most godless creature that ever walked the face of the earth, and his weaponizing of Christianity going back a few hundred years.
And who was that? Who was that?
Ignatius Loyola, the founder of the Jesuits.
Okay, keep going.
Well, all he essentially did, and I'll spell this out for your audience because they'll enjoy this. What was, and this took me years to kind of work out because I'm not that bright, but I'm good when I get a bone in my teeth. Ignatius Loyola essentially weaponized Christianity, and he created a system of allegiance and devotion to himself as the superior general. And then whoever the superior general was going to be generationally would be the Alpha and the Omega. And all Jesuits would fall under the thrall of the superior general. They would go forth. They had to take the Jesuit oath, and all you need to do is read the Jesuit oath to understand how ghastly it is. I mean, it's really very bloody and grisly what you have to swear to, that you'll rip the innards out of pregnant women and devour the womb. And you know, it's disgusting. It's everything that you hear now in affidavits and testimonies from ritual satanic abuse. And God knows I'm an expert at that stuff, having, you know, presided over these years of tribunals. But everything you hear from testimonies to ritual satanic abuse, you read essentially in the Jesuit oath. And all popes in Rome have to take the Jesuit oath. Well, go figure. Something's very wrong in the basement in the Vatican. But what he essentially did, Loyola, was set forth an army of priests, Jesuit priests, quote unquote, whose job it was ultimately to simply infiltrate the bedchambers of the kings and queens and the emperors and the empresses of old. That's what they did. They got on the ships and they went forth, humble, with a little sackcloth and a little piece of rope around the waist. And they would be barefoot and they would want for no money. They would want for no gold. They would want for no title. They wouldn't accept property. They wouldn't accept reparation or remuneration. So they, of course, very quickly inveigled themselves into the trust of the rulership of the world, from the Ming dynasties all the way through to the imperial crowns of Europe. And the next thing you know, in one or two generations, every confessor priest was a Jesuit. Clever stuff. What were they doing? All they were doing was feeding intelligence back to the superior general. And the superior general, who was the CIA and Mossad and MI5 to this day, all of that goes back to the superior general in Rome. Okay, CIA, Mossad, MI6, MI5, every single intelligence outfit in 200 nations is owned and controlled essentially by that same system. All feeds back to the superior general of otherwise known as the Black Pope.
So, Sasha, I just wish we had like 5 hours so I could ask you so many follow-up questions to what you just said. Who is the superior general today?
He's a nameless individual. I mean, you can check him out. It was Hans-Peter Kolvenbach until very recent. There was another one. He's just gone down. I'll check out for you and let you know with a message later the name of these are ignominious individuals. You've never heard of them. That you can find them. You can research and find them. But then what do you know about the Black Nobility? The Black Nobility is the real rulership. There are about 200, 230 individuals. I know every one of their names. We've got the entire index on them. They are the real figures, and some of them you probably party with without even knowing it, or go skiing in Colorado with. So it's a very curious, and I can tell you this, that many of them are wanting to bail many of the younger generations are wanting to bail now. I know because I met a number of them in the last 5-6 years, particularly, who don't want to continue with the sacraments. They don't want to get involved in the blood covenants. They will even walk away from the money and the kind of ancestral, the legacy and the ancestral homes and all of the money and what have you. But the point is that the 1% is a fallacy. It is 1% of 1% of 1% that owns everything. It is so much smaller and tighter than you could possibly imagine. Like the entire owners of the entirety of the corporations on earth and the governments on earth and the central and reserve banks on earth could literally fit into my garden here for a garden party. That's wow. The fact. And all the rest is orchestrated technocracy and bureaucracy. Clever stuff.
Wow. Whew. Wow. Like I said, I'm going to have you back. You know, I'm starting in February. I'm starting a podcast. I really want to have you back and explore some of these things.
Let's do a regular one. Detail. Very happy to do it.
Because, Instagram, it shuts you off at an hour. So we can't, you know, go much beyond the hour right. time. But Sasha, put that all in perspective for us, because your depth of knowledge and experience, I mean, I've known a lot about you, but this is just so fascinating to me. I wish I could just sit there for 10 hours and just talk to you. And I'm not exaggerating. I'm serious. I'm not exaggerating. Put that in context with what's happening today, with what's happening, you know, globally on these shutdowns and what they're kind of doing. How did they get to this point? And what do you see in the next coming for 2021 about that?
Well, again, what we're seeing today, 2020, you've got to understand or have an understanding of the Babylonian Mysterium cult and how times and dates and signatures and codes and public notice are all very important in casting black magic or juju. At this level, you have to give public notice. So it's very, very bizarre once you get into it. I spoke about this on a broadcast last week about stuff in the past that I've been called into at an intergovernmental level to work out and help to decode certain satellite images that have come in connected to the mobilization of heavy hardware and soldiers on the ground from satellite carving huge symbols in the Babylonian desert in Iraq some years ago. And the Russian intelligence couldn't work out what was happening. Why were they seeing this huge mobilization of tens of thousands of soldiers and hardware and tanks carving huge symbols in the desert, which you could only work out from space? On the ground, you would simply be following a logistical order. But they wanted to know what was going on. So good Russian scouts contacted good scouts in British intelligence, and good British intelligence scouts couldn't work it out. And they contacted good agents of theirs in Cambridge University, and good agents of theirs in Cambridge University reached out to me and Humanitat and said, we want to work. You've got great anthropologists and people on your brain trust. Can you come and help work? So we looked in on this stuff years ago to find out that indeed, entire armies are being mobilized and used to create public notice, not for Joe Public, but galactic notice. These were symbols of Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent, being carved into the desert, you know, tens of kilometers in span. And this is the kind of thing that the Babylonian Mysterium cult has been getting up to for an awful long time. They've been sequestering technologies for hundreds of years, and I mean hundreds of years, okay, because this goes back probably to the spice trade and the British East India Company, when they were really going out and finding dinosaurs' bones and giant skulls and crystal ball, you know, whatever. And all of that stuff being sequestered, brought back to the crowns of Europe and laid before the kings, you know, and then, oh my God, keep them in the basement, don't know what to do with that, you know. And the next thing, you've got the Royal Institute for International Affairs emerging, and you've got the British Museum emerging, you've got the Smithsonian Institute emerging, and the Vatican Library. The Vatican Library, dear God, you know, and what they've sequestered in these places over the last few hundred years, you wouldn't imagine. Now, there's a counterpoint to that. The Coptic bishops, I spoke about this as well last week, and I apologize if anyone's hearing me repeat myself. I went to go and stay with the Coptic bishops in the desert of Sketis in Wadi al-Natrun 17-18 years ago. And the Coptics live underground. Every time there's a war on the surface, they go into catacombs underground. They can live there for months at a time. They've got the granaries and underground wells. They're in the middle of the desert, but for thousands of years, they've been able to do that, and they've done it. And the Coptics are the midpoint between Christianity and Islam, so they're kind of a weird hybrid of a priesthood. And they're the ones who some years ago gave us the Dead Sea Scrolls and kind of tossed the Dead Sea Scrolls at us. And we were like, oh my God, that rewrote the whole, you know, they've got a whole bunch of things underground with the Coptic bishops that you wouldn't believe, okay? And they will slowly but surely release that stuff into the public domain. But there's even stranger stuff. There are people in Burma and in the Atlas Mountains of North Africa that are over 1,000 years old, individuals I'm talking about. Fact. I know two of them who I know one of them is 850 odd years and the other one is 1,104 this year. Extraordinary. These beings are otherworldly beings. But this kind of thing, I also met twice, and this is in my Facebook over the years. Anyone who follows me knows I've had the great immortal, the yogi of the immortals, has twice been to Europe on his pilgrimages in the last 12, 13 years, and on both occasions came to see me in London with his entourage. And I did stories and took photographs and things and released them on him. And I've been invited to go and stay with him in India. And he continues the tradition of the immortals through yoga. Why are we not talking about this stuff? Why is this stuff not being taught in schools and on, you know, on TV and what have you? Because all of this stuff invites us into a true knowing of the true transcendent capabilities that we have as a species, that we are so incredible, remarkable, that our DNA and RNA signatures are multidimensional and are foundationally immortal and immanent. In the status quo, the Sabbatean agenda, which is contained by the Vatican complex, does not want humans to enter supernature under any circumstance, because we do that, they lose the thrall on this earth, and they are an antenna system to lower elemental intelligences that have been living vicariously through this plane of existence for thousands and thousands of years. It's all a beautiful story, actually, because it's all part of a soul covenant, and all of us are finding our way back home through this strange cauldron.
So what's the end game for what's happening right now? I mean, where do you see, or is this just a, you know, it's another lily pad, you know, it's just something we're just, you know, lily pad to lily pad. I mean, where are we right now? And what do you perceive just in the, and we've only got like 10 minutes left, Sasha. I mean, this is just, I'm telling you, I can't wait until we can do this like much longer, because I have like I said, 50 follow-up questions I want to ask you.
We're on the brink of emancipation.
Where are we right now? And
I'm telling you. Programmed. We're being cult programmed right now to believe that we've reached the end, that we're going over a cliff, that it's end of days, that it's apocalypse, and that we've run out of gold and run out of water and run out of oxygen, and now stealth viruses abound and we're in catastrophic failure. No. The Babylonian aspect of the false light idolatrous human is under catastrophic failure. And the resurgence or the regenesis and the emergence of the true human, the Adamite, the Christed ones, that's us. And Christ is not in the Christian sense, in the sense of supernature. All persuasions, all cultures, all faiths, the common pulse of humanity, those of us who do not choose to wear masks and mask ourselves against reason, against conscience, and against God-given oxygen are the ones who are the meek. We are the meek who inherit the earth, and this is where we inherit it. So right now, I've never felt more buoyed up myself about the status quo, because I can see how the fiction is doing unto itself. And that's the global bankster, parent corporations, the imperial hegemony of the old crowns of Europe and all of their assets in the first world, which are all collapsing. The rule of law is collapsing and the economy is collapsing. Law and economics have always ever been the two horns of the devil in the false light civilizational construct. We should rejoice at this. And it doesn't matter where you are, as long as you're standing in joy and delight in being here now, the rubble will not land on your head. You will never be free from the vaccination program. You know, all of those things will pass as quickly as they came, as a bad dream. But we must anchor our plasma projection into ideation, idealizing a perfect outcome. Otherwise, we're being cult programmed into projecting our collective plasma into negative storylines. And where the mind goes, facts will follow and the body will follow. And that's really what we're at. We're at a point now of being able to extricate ourselves from thousands of years of cult programming. That surely is a beautiful thing.
That, excuse me, that is extremely powerful, what you just said, that idealizing a perfect outcome and where the mind will go, that facts will follow.
Yeah.
It's sort of like as above, so below. And, you know, and imagining, you know, what you want it to be and creating it through imagination, which is a gift that's been in all cultures and I think basically all religions forever, but has so been so suppressed because we've been so trained out of that into believing that we only believe what we can physically see and not
that's
what we're trying to manifest, right?
Yeah, exactly right. And that's it. We're moving from that third density, heavily kind of paramagnetically connected human into one that is more contained in, more connected to the fifth, so-called lower fifth density realm of expression, which is to say that we're moving into the dielectric universe. We're now coming of age and we're needing to step away from childish things like governments. We don't need fucking governments. We never needed governments. A government is an insane proposition, and we're now just learning the fact of that. To have a government now weaponized against humans and forcing us to self-harm means that it's reached the end. And that's a beautiful thing to behold. Even these imbeciles in governments, you can see the look on their faces when they're making their prepared speeches to camera. You can see they despise themselves. You can see that they're not enjoying the process any longer because it's a process that's on the brink of its own extermination. And I say 10 years from now, 2030, there's no question I'm right about this. All governments will cease to be within the next few years. No government will be able to survive because the rule of law, going back to the Bill of Rights, the Magna Carta, the papal doctrines of discovery and dum diversus, all of those are the primary contracts and covenants behind and treaties behind the fiction of governments today and the UN and the World Trade Organization. All of them are connected to that same rule of law. They're all in abrogation, derogation, and breach. Therefore, they have to be annihilated. They've failed ultimately in their manifest and in their mandate. So what moves beyond this point, Sherry, is you and is me and is good people of the living soil making determinations for ourselves.
Whew. Wow. So that's where you're going with the New Earth Project, right? To get us to all understand we're one global community. We don't need to be governed, which means corralled and put into, you know, pens and treated like slaves that and animals, actually, you know, put on your mask, stand apart, take your vaccine, you know, which is sort of like what they do to cattle, right? So this is so amazing, Sasha.
We never needed government. We never needed government. Governments only ever emerged as part of a kind of protectorate for those barons and those kings and those principalities and papacies of old that were seeking themselves to consolidate their own interests, their own wealth, their own power and dominion. So governments emerged as a protectorate for them. It never emerged as something to service and protect living men and women of the living soil. We were sold that bullshit. We believed it from the medieval days on. We believed that nonsense because the one sweet thing about humans is that we have a tendency to fall for the law of first report, which is the first thing we're told we tend to believe. We're that sweet as a species.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's also about subjugation and fear of retribution and fear of pain and, you know, all these different things. So in the last couple of minutes that we have, Sasha, and we're definitely going to do this again in a much more extended thing because this, I really want to dig into your, not just what you did and in the perspectives, but how that made you feel. I mean, where does your power come from on the inside of you? And I want to spend some time on a different conversation talking about that. But in these last couple of minutes that we have here, What's the take-home message you want to leave everybody with this morning?
Oh, pay little to no attention to government. They're all, as I said, I understand a great deal about law. I mean, I've become something, I'm not going to call myself an expert, but I've become somewhat expert in so many different arenas of focus in law over the last 5-6 years. And I can tell you that there is little to nothing that your government is doing that is falls within the remit of law or the rule of law. Therefore, pay little to no attention to it. Certainly, you shouldn't be paying personal income taxes. That's an insane proposition. You should not be paying attention to lawless statutes. Statutes are not laws. Study up on the difference. A statute is something which is dreamt up by a technocracy and enforced by thugs unlawfully. So police are not allowed to enforce statutes unless the people agree to it. The people don't agree to it, so don't go for it. Don't wear masks under any circumstances and deprive yourself of oxygen. Don't eat glyphosates. Don't eat processed foods. Drink structurized water. Love and be loved as boldly and wildly, as madly as you can. Embrace one another. Kick your shoes off. Pay no attention to rules and regulations and statutes and codes and provisions and ordinances. They were only ever there designed to curtail your own immanence, your own immortality, and your own immeasurable beauty. Simple as that.
Well, amen, brother. Wow. So I can't wait to see how this is going to unfold. You've just given me such an inspiration this morning to stop getting, to stay out of the weeds, you know, to stay out of the weeds that, you know, it's just a play. It's just, this is it's a multi-act play. You know, we have three-act plays or whatever. It's a multi-act play. This is just one play, one act in the play. As we go through the involution of all of these different structures that need to fall apart, all these different structures that fall apart, that need to fall apart over millennia. I mean, you know, we've got at least 2,000 years since Christ was here, you know, since Muhammad was here, that it's time for that millennial change, for people to step into their power of who they are spiritually, mentally, emotionally, and stop giving away our power. Stop giving it away.
Yes, indeed. Beautifully stated. Beautifully stated. What you just said about watching that you don't get entangled with the weeds, I love that because it's so true. I mean, my living credo is to simply conduct right action and pure truth in the living now, which is always the path of least resistance to the highest outcome. And that is my entire spiritual philosophy in one sentence. But moreover, to also weigh and measure every word and thought and action and watch the motion of your feet on the journey. That's all you really need to do, is watch the motion of your feet on the journey. It is a journey. Everything's a journey. Never try to arrive. Never hold an objective or a destination in mind particularly. It really must increasingly become quantum and become about this never-ending journey of discovery, of revelation, of beauty, and the affirmation of art and beauty and consciousness in our lives.
So, Sasha, how do we get in touch with you? We've got about 2 minutes. And follow up with what you are doing with the New Earth Project. How does, because everybody here, there's thousands of people on here this morning, and there's going to be lots of people that are going to watch this in the follow up. What is your call to action for the people that are here and the New Earth Project? What would be your call to action?
I'm only now just starting to get my act together, and I'm under a lot of pressure to do it. So, sashastone.com. SashaStone.com is the prime website, and I'll be releasing a newsletter, a weekly journal newsletter. For the first time, I've been coerced into doing it, and I'm actually looking forward to it because I've been very disorganized for many years, and I feel I should just be a little bit more focused, and I'm going to start next week onward. So anyone subscribing there at SashaStone.com, I'll direct you to the International Tribunal for Natural Justice, to the New Earth Project, and to the Works of Humanitad, the World Health Sovereignty Summit, and the other initiatives that I've initialized. There, I'll lay that all out, and also some of the more focused media, I will get that out to people through those weekly reports.
Oh, that's going to be amazing. I'm going to be one of your first people to sign up.
Well, that's kind. Thank you, Sherry.
Because then we can promote that and we can do all sorts of things with it, because this is where humanity needs to go, Sasha. We need somebody with your level of experience and background, with all the diverse experiences that you've just run through so quickly here. I'm sure that there's hundreds more. And there's lots of stories and very pivotal things that you could share that would help to restructure humanity's thinking about where we are. And the moving forward of this is the leadership that we need. Is what we really super need. So thank you for staying up late there for me in Bali, where you are. And I can't wait till we do this again in a much more detail and talk about it. So it's sashastone.com. Yes, everybody keeps asking, are we going to save this? Are we going to save this? Yes, we'll save it. You can watch it here. You can watch it on Instagram Live. It'll be on disseminate.tv. It'll be on Rumble. We'll post it all sorts of different places. So I know it took us a little while to get this set up, but I am so grateful. And now this is this your inaugural event on Instagram Live?
You just nailed my virginity. Well done, Sherry. Thank you. Thank you.
So that we've pulled you into a whole new venue of doing lives like
indeed.
This.
Indeed. Look forward to seeing you more regularly. I'll be very happy to do that.
Absolutely. We will do that. So you guys have a great rest of the week. Come with us tomorrow night. Happy hour with Dr. T at 6 o'clock. You know, we do these every morning at 9. We will save this. You'll be able to watch it. Sasha, God bless you. Thank you so much for what you're doing
Thank
for
you,
humanity. I love you so much. Take care. Bye-bye.